Mr. Hedrick.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. As indicated, my name is John Hedrick, and I represent Town Center Mall Limited Partnership. This appeal arises from a three-day bench trial in which a trial court rendered judgment in favor of Nevada C. Dyer, DBA Ancast Enterprises. And during my argument today, I'd like to address three reasons why the trial court's judgment is erroneous. First, the trial court lacks subject matter jurisdiction over Dyer's lawsuit because Dyer lacks standing to assert claims on behalf of Ancast Enterprises. Second, the evidence actually in the record does not support the judgment. And third, the trial court's award of attorney's fees to Dyer is not supported because Dyer failed to articulate a basis upon which attorney's fees can be recovered. Now, turning to my first point, Dyer lacks standing to assert claims on behalf of Ancast Enterprises because any alleged injury suffered by Dyer is derivative of an alleged injury to Ancast Enterprises.
But wasn't Dyer doing business as Ancast Enterprises?
No, Your Honor, Dyer was not. Letitia Ozuna filed the DBA on behalf of Ancast Enterprises. Dyer filed a DBA on behalf of Ancast Enterprises with two S's. The record's pretty clear on this point that Ancast Enterprises was operated as a partnership between Letitia Ozuna and Nevada Dyer. And Dyer testified at trial that they both split the profits. Dyer even pled that Letitia Ozuna was a part owner of Ancast Enterprises. In Dyer's trial testimony, she refers to Letitia as a partner in Ancast Enterprises. And Dyer's trial counsel in his attorney's fees affidavit even identifies his client as Nevada Dyer and Letitia Ozuna, DBA Ancast Enterprises.
But why does it matter which partner filed the DBA? Aren't they both doing business as Ancast Enterprises?
Well, no, Your Honor. Ancast Enterprises is a general partnership, and while they both may be general partners, should the general partnership bring a claim on behalf of itself, it needs to be in the partnership name or every...
I thought they weren't a partnership except for in some casual sense, and that they were just a DBA. I mean, I don't know of any rule that only one person can be involved in a DBA.
Well, if we're not going to call it a partnership, then Letitia Ozuna is the rightful sole proprietor of Ancast Enterprises, not Nevada Dyer. The issue is that both partners or both individuals need to be joined in this lawsuit, because if they're not joined in this lawsuit, Town Center Mall is going to be subjected to not only a lawsuit from Nevada Dyer, but then also separately from Letitia Ozuna, arising from the same actions and seeking the same damages due to those actions. And, okay. Well, Your Honor, under the common law, when an entity is operated in the, specific instance at hand, both individuals are going to need to be joined in the lawsuit if it's a contractual action, because any damages that they may assert are on behalf of the entity that they're operating as, which is Ancast Enterprises in this case. And the purpose behind the rules, what I just said. Now, furthermore, the Fifth Court of Appeals has had a long line of cases recently wherein the basic premise that individual shareholders or members of LLCs cannot bring suit on behalf of the entity is being extended to limited partnerships. Now, the reasoning behind that is because the cause of action is owned by the partnership itself, not
this
the individual.
This isn't a limited partnership, is it?
No, Your Honor, it's not. It's a general partnership operated between Nevada Dyer and Letitia Ozuna.
But there's no partnership agreement. There's been no partnership papers filed with anybody, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
So but, it's a DBA.
Well, there's a DBA filed by Letitia Ozuna, not Nevada Dyer, since both parties entered into or decided
so
to.
So essentially it's your position that a DBA can only be one person.
When a sole proprietor files the DBA and she specifically identifies the DBA as a sole proprietorship, then in that instance, it can be a sole proprietorship. That's the evidence that we have in the record that Letitia Ozuna filed the assumed name certificate on behalf of Ancast Enterprises and identified herself as the DBA as a sole proprietor. Now, when Nevada Dyer came into the equation and decided to operate as part of Ancast Enterprises, we have a meeting of the minds where they're going to operate as a partnership. And I guess the reasoning behind the extension of an individual partner, shareholder, or member of an entity not being able to bring suit on behalf of that entity is because the individuals don't own the cause of action. In this case, Nevada Dyer and Leticia Ozuna's, I guess, sole damages would be the loss of value of their entity, which is ANCAS Enterprises. Because every...
I'm thinking that we're treading around here of the fact that it's not... I know that you know what you mean. The form for filing an assumed name. An individual files the assumed name certificate and puts the name of the entity on the application for filing of an assumed name certificate, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Leticia Ozuna filed an application for a assumed name certificate or filed the assumed name certificate on behalf of ANKAS Enterprises.
Yes, Your Honor.
But Ms. Dyer, Nevada Dyer, filed a additional assumed name certificate in which she listed the entity she was filing for as ANKASS Enterprises.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, isn't that the bottom line to all this argument and discussion we've been just talking about in terms of the propriety of a lawsuit being filed for ANKAS Enterprises by Ms. Dyer, whose assumed name certificate was different?
Yes, Your Honor, that's absolutely correct. If she was to have standing under any DBA, it would be under the ANCAS with two S's.
And none of the contracts was with ANKASS Enterprises?
Correct, Your Honor. Every contract entered into in this suit was between ANCAS with one S and Town Center Mall Limited Partnership, and any miscellaneous work that may have been performed was performed by ANCAS Enterprises with one S.
All right, thank you.
Now, to the extent that Dyer lacks standing to assert claims on behalf of ANCAS with one S, the trial court lacked the subject matter jurisdiction, and the trial court's judgment should be reversed, and an order should be issued from this court dismissing Dyer's claims against Town Center. Now, for the sake of argument, if we're going to assume that Dyer did have standing to assert the claims on behalf of ANCAS, the evidence in the record still does not support the judgment. Now, at trial, Dyer rested her case subject to attorney's fees without ever admitting a single exhibit. After Town Center rested its case, Dyer then offers two binders full of exhibits to the trial court. Town Center orally objects in addition to written objections that it filed pre-trial, and the court took its ruling under advisement. Nearly 9 months later, trial court rendered judgment on behalf of Dyer. However, there was no express admission of any of the exhibits going to Dyer's merits before that date. On July 1st, the trial court then issued its findings of fact and conclusions of law. Still, there's no express admission of Dyer's exhibits going to the merits. 3 weeks later, the court issued an order denying each and every objection asserted by Town Center. However, there's no language in that order that expressly admits Dyer's exhibits going to the merits of her claim. Now, this is problematic because Dyer had the affirmative burden to show that the exhibits going to the merits of her claims were both properly offered and that the trial court expressly admitted those exhibits into evidence during trial. Without such a showing, the exhibits going to the merits are going to be considered loose and form no part of the appellate record. Furthermore, any express admission that Dyer must have obtained must have occurred prior to the rendition of judgment. Now, there's not a whole lot of case law on this topic, but the Texas legislature contemplated the issue when enacting Texas Rule Civil Procedure 270. And paraphrasing that rule, if a party wants to supplement evidence, it must clearly appear necessary to the due administration of justice that the court may permit additional evidence to be offered at any time. And then it goes further and says, provided that in jury trials, no evidence on a controversial matter shall be received after the jury's verdict. Now, the logic behind Rule 270 can be applied to a bench trial when we're talking about when the evidence can be admitted. After a judgment's been rendered, no further evidence can be admitted. And this is because if a party is given the opportunity to admit evidence after the rendition of judgment, the opponent of the evidence is necessarily deprived of their opportunity to cross-examine based upon that evidence, rebut any purported evidence, or...
How was evidence admitted after judgment?
Well, it's not, and the appellees in this case are contending that the July 22nd order denying each and every objection asserted by Town Center constitutes an implied admission of the of Dyer's evidence. So, to answer your question directly, that there is no admission of evidence in this case, and there cannot be one after a rendition of judgment because the judge has already made its ruling.
But that you said the judge didn't rule for several months.
Well, correct. The judge did not render judgment for 9 months. And after, I guess, during that period, Dyer did not seek any admission of the evidence whatsoever. There were really no filings going on at that time. And then upon the render of judgment, all the post-trial motions started. And with all of Dyer's post-trial motions, there's still no seeking of an admission of evidence. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that first, there's no express admission of evidence either way. And then even if we're going to call the court's order denying each and every objection some sort of implied admission of evidence, it still doesn't constitute an admission because it must occur prior to the rendition of judgment. Now, in this case, Dyer still didn't seek any sort of Rule 270 hearing or an admission of evidence under 270. And without doing so, she's waived her opportunity to supplement evidence. Now, without the admission of Dyer's exhibits going to the merits of her claim, the judgment below is not supported based on the evidence actually in the record. The trial court found for Dyer on three causes of action: breach of contract, quantum merit, and suit on sworn account. The breach of contract award to Dyer is problematic for numerous reasons. The first and foremost is that Dyer wasn't a party to contracts 2, 4, and 5. Furthermore, there's no evidence in the record that Dyer actually performed the scope of work that was contemplated under contracts 2, 4, and 5. And in reality, the record actually reflects that Town Center paid on contracts 2, 4, and 5 to Dyer. Contract 2 was paid with check number 4958, and this is all included in Defense Exhibit 4. Contract 4 was paid with checks number 5206 and 5444, and contract 5 was paid with check 5444. So without any evidence that Dyer was a party to the contracts, that Dyer performed under the contracts, and that the evidence actually shows that Town Center paid under the contracts, there's no evidence to support the trial court's
You're
judgment.
Saying that Dyer was paid. Are you meaning Ancus Enterprises?
Yes, Your Honor. Excuse me. Ancus Enterprises was paid, and all the checks that were issued by Town Center Mall directly to Ancus Enterprises. And all the contracts 2, 4, and 5 were all signed by Dyer in her capacity as an owner and operator of Ancus Enterprises. Now, the quantum merit claim fails on its face because the trial court's finding necessarily negates an action for quantum merit. Finding of fact number 5 states that the miscellaneous tasks that Dyer claims were performed should have been change orders pursuant to the written contracts. Because they weren't, I guess, standalone work and they should have been properly included under written contracts, we can't consider that services rendered outside, or I guess separate services rendered. Any work that she's claiming that was done as a miscellaneous task should have been included under the scope of a breach of contract. The suit on a sworn account claim is also unsupported, and this is for numerous reasons, the first of which, the trial court's reliance upon Texas Rule Civil Procedure 185 and Dyer's second amended petition is erroneous. Texas Rule Civil Procedure 185 allows a party to file a suit on a sworn account provided they provide the court with a systematic accounting of their records. Dyer's second amended petition contains no such systematic accounting. Furthermore, Town Center filed a verified denial, which essentially negates the effect of pleading a suit on a sworn account. Thus, Dyer's exhibits going to the merits of her claims were not admitted by the trial court, and the evidence in the record does not support the trial court's judgment. Now, my final issue that I want to get to is that Dyer failed to articulate a claim for attorney's fees. In her pleading, she sought attorney's fees under a quantum merit theory without pleading the factual predicate that's required. Town Center's verified denial specifically identified this defect, yet Dyer opted not to cure the problem. In her response brief, Dyer identifies Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code Chapter 38 for the first time, and I see that my time's out. May I
finish that thought?
Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code Chapter 38 applies solely to individuals and corporations. Town Center Mall is operated as a limited partnership, and the 14th Court of Appeals, the First Court of Appeals, they're all on point on this, that a partnership does not constitute an individual or corporation. As such, Town Center is not subject to an award of attorney's fees under Chapter 38.
Sir, for your argument. We'll add a little bit of time for the appellate.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. It's nice to be here this afternoon. Justice Walker, I think picking up on your comments on the standing, there were no pleadings that they alleged that Nevada Dyer was a partner. They obtained no findings of a partnership. They have not challenged the lack of findings on a partnership. And Justice Meyer, you picked up on that. There's absolutely no indication of meeting any of the five elements in the record that they were a partnership. And they've received no findings on that, and they made no challenge that on the Court of Appeals before us today. What we do have is, at most, a typo with the extra S, but that's why Rule 28 was implemented, because Rule 28 expressly authorizes individuals to do business under DBAs. And if the other side objects to it or opposes it, they are to file a motion to try to properly align those parties. And what they haven't pointed out is that Nevada Dyer filed a verified pleading, which was before the trial court, that she was authorized to bring this act, was authorized representative of Ancus. So under any scenario, which is properly, perfectly appropriate to bring it under a DBA, which they do all of the time, if the party objects somehow, the Supreme Court has set up a procedure to address that. If for some reason this court were to reach that she wasn't authorized to bring this, she specifically filed a verification that she was the representative of Ancus to bring this action. I think under any of these criterias, they clearly are the proper party. And if anything, it's at the very most a capacity issue, which they don't raise. And that's the problem you have, Justice Meyer, is when they switch horses in the middle of a case, because they pled this as a capacity case, and on appeal they're raising it as a standing case.
Mr. Michelle, the evidence that I see referenced about the formation of Ancus Enterprises, they're in the record is testimony that the business was formed as a entity to engage in submitting contracts to Town Center Mall LP, and that the business was formed with Letitia Ozuna and Nevada Dyer as people who were forming the entity. That's in the record, isn't it?
Those statements are, but they're not entities, Your Honor. That's the difference.
They're individuals. Clearly they're individuals, and
correct.
They were individuals who were engaging in the idea and followed through with the actual practice of submitting for contracts with the Town Center.
Correct. Ancus is not an entity.
It's named in the contracts as
it is, as a DBA. That is correct, Your Honor. And that's what you do if you sign contracts in a DBA. And that's why you file on public notice an assumed name, a DBA certificate of the public records. That's why those are set up that way. It's on public notice. And so if they objected, that's why it all dovetails together, Your Honor. If they then had an objection to the way this was being conducted, they want to bring it to the court's attention, raise it, file a motion, and if that's really their contention, let's get the right parties in front of the court instead of this technical attempt to gotcha. That's why these rules are in place, to avoid all of that. And to come up and argue for the first time on appeal that they lock standing, because they never did contest that the charges weren't reasonable. They didn't really contest or call any witnesses that the work wasn't done. This entire appeal is about technical gotchas. And that's what's unique about DBAs. Rule 28, and we've cited cases in there, that it's their burden to come in and do that. They didn't do that. Now, they assume, and they present it to you, Justice Meyer, in all due respect to their position, their entire brief reads as if it's an entity. They just make it a self-fulfilling fact that it's a partnership. They don't cite any records. They don't cite any evidence. They don't cite any findings. They don't submit any proposed findings of facts to say you failed to find that they were a partner and didn't allege that they were partners. They only alleged lack of capacity. And the other, Ms. Ozuna, if you allege it's a necessary party, the Supreme Court has ruled, I didn't anticipate this was going to be an issue on appeal, but they should have made her, if they wanted to, made her a necessary party. If that's what they're, the Supreme Court has spoken to that issue, that is a waivable issue on their part, if they truly felt she was a necessary party. But this all dovetails together in that there was a verified pleading as well that Ms. Dyer said she was authorized representative of ANCGIS. So we're here, it's one party, it's one recovery, and they never did anything to bring anybody else in there except now allege and change theories for the first time on appeal understanding.
So it's your position that because of the DBA was properly named as ANCGIS, it doesn't matter who the person before that was. In the pleadings, it could have been Mickey Mouse, and if they thought that Mickey Mouse wasn't the DBA or the DBA wasn't ANCGIS, they could file a motion and have the actual person substituted in.
Absolutely. That's what Rule 28 is for. And it expressly states, but on a motion by any party or on the court's own motion, the true name may be substituted. It all dovetails together. It makes sense. The goal, as with most rules of law, are to get justice done in an appropriate manner and give the parties an opportunity to respond. And that's what was all here, and that was all open to them, and which they did not do. I'm going to jump really quick to the attorney's fees issue. They did not object to the admission of the evidence on attorney's fees as to segregating attorney's fees. That is waived. Justice Stofano and Justice Walker, you were on the panel with former Chief Justice Casey in the Hawkins case, in which you have got to waive to failure to segregate attorney's fees. That site is 233 Southwest 3rd, 380 at 398. Additionally, suit on sworn account, Quantum Merowit, and breach of contract all give rise to attorney's fees. All of the work is basically the same, intertwined under Tony Gola Motors' case, that they are trying to get paid for the work they performed. Those are all tied together.
Can you tell us the factual sequence of the evidentiary issue, the late submission of evidence raised by the attorney?
Yes. Those binders were submitted. The evidence was submitted to Judge Lowe, received by Judge Lowe. They took a break, and it's cited in our brief, Your Honor. Judge Lowe gave them, and they raised an objection to a blue binder and a black binder because there were some handwritten notations. Trial counsel corrected that and submitted a clean version of the binders and gave them a break and an opportunity to inspect them. They had lodged some objections. Judge Lowe did take that under advisement. However, I do have to correct, nobody's trying to supplement the evidence with new evidence that was not tendered and submitted to the trial court.
On the day of trial.
On the day of trial. Yes, during trial. Absolutely, Your Honor.
And once the order entered that says all objections are overruled?
Yes, that is after, Your Honor. That is,
when is that?
That is after the judgment. And we have cited Rule 270 that cites at any time. It's not new evidence. It's the evidence that was already tendered during trial. It's just the ruling that was made, overruling the objections.
And so it's your position that there's not a need for the trial judge to state these exhibits are admitted?
You know, Justice Meyer, it's, you know, I think every one of us has probably practiced a long time with that notation, but clearly Rule 33 states that rulings can be made implicitly or explicitly?
I remember a lot of rulings that I thought should have been made implicitly and explicitly, or maybe even by implication, whatever I was practicing law.
Yes.
But I never was able to seem to get that by.
We do have an express ruling by Judge Lowe overruling the objections.
So it's your position that he implicitly overruled them and then kind of as a housekeeping matter for appeal made an express ruling?
Correct. What we don't, and Justice Meyer, you're correct. What we don't have, we do not have an express written ruling saying that the objections are overruled and I'm admitting them. We don't have that express in the right and in the order. However, I would argue, and we did cite a case, Your Honor, that cites that when they, in fact, similar to this, where they overrule the objections, and especially in this proceeding where it was an issue, it was a topic with the court, it was presented during trial. We did what we could do to get a ruling from the trial court. We wished it was earlier, but that is the trial judge's. We can emphasize those. He took it under advisement, and he finally.
Doesn't that happen all the time in summary judgments?
All the time. All the time. Absolutely. Same with objections.
It's also a trial.
It is a trial. It's also a trial. Also, you have objections that are implicitly overruled by the conduct, which this court has cited a number of times as well. Once again, I think the purpose of what is the intent is they presented their objections. They were considered by the trial court and ruled on by the trial court. So I think we're advancing the process here by allowing this case to proceed as to the merits of the case. In short, with regard to their, I'm trying to hit their last points. Ones of admitting the evidence. There's a number of issues. They raise an amazing number of procedural hurdles, technical procedural hurdles throughout the things, many of which are not preserved in the record at all. They didn't waive. They objected. They failed to object under any defects of pleadings under Rule 91 with regard to a sworn account. We've cited cases that you don't have to have the particularization under Rule 183. Once again, that's not necessary. With regard to the evidence that was submitted, that was admitted as we discussed, and Nevada Dyer testified that all of the work was requested by them. She never did this on her own by spec. Rarely have I ever seen a contractor who's being required to expedite their activity is going to voluntarily do work, although there's testimony in there that it was requested, it was undisputed and uncontradicted, and that the work that was done was reasonable and customary. They've had to go through an extraordinary amount of effort, including now coming up here on appeal, trying to recover. Regard to findings, they're talking about under quantum merit that some of the findings may not be sufficient enough. They did not submit or request additional findings of facts and conclusions of laws on admitted elements. Therefore, those are waived. I've addressed the issue with the binders. In short, what the appellee is trying to recover here is simply getting paid for work that was performed. They do contend that there were some releases that were signed that releases all of the claims, Justice Meyer. However, those are blank forms. They don't identify the contracts that they're allegedly releasing them on. I think that's almost somewhat evidence of how quickly this project was moving at the requesting and trying to be responsive. I think we've all known contractors who are trying to keep their project moving and being compliant and doing the work. With regard to the releases also, they did not set forth or respond really to that. The fact that their contracts didn't say the releases were to what contract they were addressing. Also, much of the work was performed after that term. They try to claim in their brief sometimes that what they did was performing on oral contracts. Actually, that's the additional work I think that you often see. That part obviously was orally requested for that work to be performed. They did perform it, and to say that it wasn't requested, they actually paid on part of those claims. So I find it very disingenuous to say, on appeal, because they don't have the evidence in the record, we're saying, that they have no evidence that was requested. And yet the very evidence in the record shows that they paid at least part of those claims. Did they magically appear? No. They were requested, performed, they made efforts. There's emails in Exhibit 30 of Plaintiff's Exhibit that they acknowledged payment was owed, and yet undone. In short, we're requesting that this court affirm the judgment of the trial court and allow the appellee to get paid for the work that she performed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Do you have rebuttal?
Thank you. To address two of the points that Appley made, the standing issue was absolutely raised by Town Center at the trial level. Town Center filed a verified denial alleging that Dyer did not have the capacity to bring the suit in which she did, and also that Letitia Ozuna as a part owner of ANCAS Enterprises was a necessary party to the lawsuit. That's at the clerk's record, page 93.
But capacity is different from standing.
Absolutely. And I guess Appley was saying that we waived all those arguments at the trial court level. These were all raised. They were all put before the trial court. Trial court rendered judgment in favor of Dyer based on the pleadings. And the verified denial explicitly stated that the proper parties to the suit were not there. Letitia Ozuna was a necessary party to the lawsuit. And that, I guess, a third defect with the parties is that Dyer didn't have the capacity to bring suit on behalf of ANCAS, even if the other two are waived. Now, the fact that she's authorized to bring the case on behalf of ANCAS Enterprises is really telling to the structure of this. She had to seek specific authorization from the partnership to bring suit on behalf of the partnership.
What's the evidence in the record of the partnership?
The evidence in the record of a partnership is Nevada Dyer testified that her and Letitia split the profits of ANCAS Enterprises 50-50, that she pled Letitia was a part owner of ANCAS Enterprises. She actually refers to Letitia Ozuna as a partner in ANCAS Enterprises in Volume 3 of the reporter's record at page 112 and 113. All of that indicates this was operated as a partnership. Dyer's own trial counsel recognized it as a partnership in its attorney's fees affidavit by specifically stating Nevada Dyer and Letitia Ozuna were doing business as ANCAS Enterprises. It wasn't one or the other. Both parties joined in together to operate ANCAS Enterprises for the construction of work at La Grande Plaza. Now, moving over to the evidentiary issues, there can't be the cases that Appley cites to were both criminal cases, and they were in the context of implicit overruling of objections. That's not quite the same as an implicit admission of evidence. They dealt with expert witnesses being offered, their testimony being offered, as well as extraneous offense testimony being offered. It did not deal with the admission of exhibits going to the very merits of the case. In fact, in Dallas Market Center versus the Swing Incorporated, absent a showing that the tendered exhibits by the plaintiff were admitted into evidence during trial, the tendered exhibits form no part of the appellate record. And as admitted by Appley on appeal, the tendered exhibits were not admitted in the record prior to rendition of judgment. They may have been offered, and while I do take issue with the statement that both binders were offered to opposing counsel, we did not receive a clean version of this binder. There was markings all in one version of the binder by the plaintiff herself, and then there's allegedly this clean version that we never got the opportunity to inspect. Furthermore,
so you don't think that the trial court could take it under advisement?
Well, the trial court could take the ruling under advisement, but without the express admission of the trial exhibits, they're considered loose and they do not form a part of the appellate record.
So they were offered, and the trial court said, I'm going to take the ruling under advisement.
Correct.
And then he can't enter a judgment without an express ruling? That's what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, I guess the opponent of the evidence needs to have the opportunity to rebut and possibly cross-examine the actual sequence of events regarding the admission of evidence was it was after both parties rested their case. Without reopening, moving to reopen evidence, Dyer offers these exhibits.
But you asserted objections.
We did. We asserted objections pretrial. And then we asserted oral objections, reiterating those objections in addition to any others that may have been lodged at that time. But for 9 months, while this the ruling was held under advisement, the trial court opted to render judgment without ever admitting the evidence. Now, in regards to the oral modifications of the contract, the Town Center did pay on some of these oral modifications. However, that's because there was proper evidence presented to Town Center of what the oral modifications were. There's no evidence in the record to support invoices or emails or letters demanding payment for all these oral modifications that Dyer alleges. For the foregoing reasons, Town Center respectfully requests that this court reverse the trial court's judgment. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your briefing and your presentations here today. Been very helpful. And your case is submitted.